From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was a patient that got Dr. Sudartha Mukherjee thinking about writing a book on cancer. The woman's own version of cancer had relapsed, and she wanted to understand exactly what she was up against. Not just the treatment and the odds of survival, but a deeper understanding of this disease. As he was working on the book, Mukherjee says it started to feel as though he wasn't writing about something, but someone. And so a history of cancer seemed inadequate. Instead, he wrote something more visceral, more personal. His book became a biography. Today in the program, Dr. Mukherjee is joining us to talk about the book, which explores the past, the future, and our complicated relationship with the most elemental disease in human history. Please join us after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you think about cancer just as a disease, it limits not only your understanding of it, but the way you treat it and fight it and live with it. In its most basic form, cancer is a cell that's jumped the track, a mutation that has grown beyond its boundaries. It's ancient and deadly, but Dr. Sudartha Mukherjee says cancer cells are a more perfect version of ourselves, growing and recovering and adapting. Mukherjee's new book explores the disease that will kill 7 million humans around the world this year. Part of the book is history, like the description of cancer found in an ancient Egyptian scroll. But this is also about human culture and imagination, hubris and false hope. Mukherjee says he's trying to enter the mind of cancer, so he calls his book not a history, but a biography. It's called The Emperor of All Maladies, and today in the program, Dr. Mukherjee is joining us to talk about it. Sudartha Mukherjee is a cancer physician at Columbia University's Medical Center, also an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia. The Emperor of All Maladies, we should say, is his first book, and he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Dr. Mukherjee, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin, if we could, with, as I understand it anyway, the story that really got you thinking about the history and the biography of cancer. It's a woman you were treating who had been able to sort of deal and treat stomach cancer. She had dealt with it for several years, but the cancer comes back. And you talk about how, I guess it's February 2005, you met with her, and part of the reason was to sort of talk about this way forward, you know, drugs and, you know, and therapies. But in the book, you say you also wanted to kind of make this reconciliation between her and her condition. Take it from there. Explain how that sort of got you thinking in a deeper way about all of this.
Well, this woman had an incredible. She was one of my patients, and she had had an incredible response to a new drug, an incredible remission, and that was unfortunately followed by a relapse. Mm-hmm. And this process had gone on for her for a long time, and at one point of time, we had become very close as we had gone forward in this journey. And at one point of time, she said, "Sid, you know, I'm willing to go on, but I need to know what it is that I'm battling." Mm. And it was a very, very humbling moment for me, because she was asking a question really about what the origins of cancer were, and what was the shape of this disease, what was happening next. And so not only that, I couldn't point her to a resource or a book that would tell her the story. What is the story of cancer? Why is it that cancer exists in the world? What happens next to it? And so so I thought that, you know, that was the inspiration to begin to write the book. And not only was she asking this question, but nearly every patient that I encountered in treating cancer or their families were all asking the same question: what is its history? And it was amazing to me that such a history didn't exist.
Why do you think that is? Do you think in some ways that explains just how elusive cancer is, not as just as a disease, but as an idea? Why wasn't there?
Well, you know, there have been certainly some attempts to write histories like this, but they actually date quite a while ago, in the 1960s and 1970s. Part of the answer, I think, lies in the fact that cancer is not one disease, but many diseases.
Right.
And so it's a little bit daunting to stitch together a narrative that links all of these diseases. But that said, it's very clear to me that despite the fact that there are many diseases, there are very deep biological, political, and cultural parallels that run through all of these diseases. You know, in other words, when we use the word, you know, there are cancer centers in a single place where all these diseases are treated. People train in cancer biology. They don't train in breast cancer biology. They don't train in you know, lung cancer biology. There are overarching themes that guide this this family of diseases. And I think part of the problem was it was a problem of narrative. I mean, how does one connect this family of diseases, which has had such a such an overarching, overwhelming effect on our public and personal life today, into how does one roll all of this into a single cohesive narrative? That was a challenge in the book.
Did it surprise you how personal the book became?
It was surprising, actually. In a sense, I had started off this book writing with a little more detachment from the history. But while I was writing the book, I was also training in cancer medicine, and I felt it was inevitable. You know, this book would be a very different book if it wasn't personal. So the thread of my own patient stories that stitches the entire book together becomes very much part of the book. In fact, the book opens, as you know very well, with such a story, and it actually closes with such a story. In fact, we follow one patient right through the entirety of the book, and she becomes emblematic of the much larger canvas of history. And I think, again, that helped. I'll tell you why it helped. Because, once again, it's very easy. Cancer affects cancer affects single individuals. You become very detached if you write about medicine in the abstract. And so it felt it was very important that while I was painting a portrait in this larger canvas that spanned from 4,000 years ago to the current moment, it was also necessary to show what it does to a single person in a single family. And that was a very important impulse in the book.
So tell us for a moment, if you would, about Carla Reed, 30-year-old kindergarten teacher. She's from Ipswich, Massachusetts, and I guess it almost seems it came upon her suddenly. She doesn't feel well.
Yes. I mean, one note, of course, is that I changed a lot of the names and many identifying details. But Carla is a real patient of mine. And she had a particularly aggressive form of leukemia. She's a young school teacher with three children, in the middle of her personal and professional life, busy family, running around, taking care of her family, her children, her school job. And then all of a sudden she gets struck by illness. And it's an illness that initially is so vague, so diffuse, that she can't even make head or tail of it. She is intensely tired. This is a woman who's normally incredibly energetic, running around behind 4 and 6-year-olds, who comes back home every day. And she says to me, I mean, eventually when we met, she says to me, you know, there are days for a month or two in which I would have to walk on all fours between one room and the other. I was so tired. I would get up in the morning and I would say to myself, that, you know, 18 hours stretch ahead in front of me. It's like an ocean. And she would haul herself back to sleep again. And she went to see her doctor and a nurse practitioner and came back without a diagnosis until at last she had a blood test done. And the blood test revealed that her blood counts, her red blood count, her hemoglobin count was absolutely critically low. And instead, what was growing in her blood was a cancer of the white blood cells, which is leukemia, lymphoblastic leukemia, an incredibly aggressive variant of cancer. And the doctors essentially took one look at the blood and said, this is just, you know, she was in the community. She was immediately packed off to the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, where I was in training at that time.
So I wanted to ask you about... you talk about in the book as you're training that people advised you kind of all along, look, if you're going to get into cancer research, if you're going to be involved in this professionally, that you've got to have, I think they said, put it this way, you've got to find a life, an interest outside of the hospital, because I think they said to you, cancer can be all-consuming, that you could get swallowed by it. Did you find that, and do you still find that?
I think there's little doubt about the fact that cancer can be all-consuming. It there's a quote in the book which I use from Jason Schindler, a poet who was dying of cancer, who says, being diagnosed with cancer is like having your face pressed up against the glass of your life. This idea that you're just so it takes you over so immediately that you're literally pressed up. And in fact, I modified that quote and I said, well, what do patients see through that glass? In fact, they don't see a world outside, but they see a world of cancer reflected and re-reflected back to them, because it is such an overwhelming presence in the life of a person or someone. When a loved one is diagnosed, it takes on an overwhelming presence. So I think it is impossible not to be swallowed. I think it is an immersive discipline, cancer biology, cancer medicine. The minute you enter the cancer wards, it takes over your life in a very particular way. But I also wanted to respond to that, and by saying, I want to be part of that immersion. And the book is a result of that immersion, not taking your eyes away from what it really is, confronting the emperor, the enemy, in its all its fullness.
I don't want to sort of make too much of this, I suppose, but it does seem that things did converge to help you write this book in some ways, I guess, to put it that way. I mean, there's an amazing story of you traveling to India and having this experience of finding this biographer who found this this person that you talk about, this obsession of finding the first patients of certain things. And so I guess it just seems like, in some ways, do you have a sense that you were meant to write this book, or that things converged because you were intended to in some kind of cosmic way?
Well, let me tell you that story again, because then you can, one can decide, your listeners can decide what converges and what doesn't converge. Yeah. Part of my impulse or my instinct when I was starting to write this book was, this book had to be about patients. I mean, this is a history of cancer, obviously, as I said before, writ large on a very large canvas. And yet that history is carried on the backs of doctors and patients. And it's about the interaction between doctors and patients. And so my question was, well, where are the patients? Who was the first, person to be diagnosed with leukemia? When is the first time, who was the first recipient of a brand new drug? And so one of these very early moments was, as you know, the book talks, the thread of the book is, the book is threaded together with a history in Boston, an amazing history of Sidney Farber.
Yeah.
And here's a man who discovers chemotherapy. And I wanted to find out who was the first, he was treating children with leukemia, and I wanted to find out who was the first child with leukemia. And I couldn't. Years went by. I mean, this book took a long time to write, and years went by, and I kept trying to find this child with leukemia. I would send a message on listservs in Boston saying, if you were a child that was diagnosed with leukemia and treated in Sidney Farber's clinic in 1948, please write to me, obviously knowing that the child had died, but the parents and the family was alive. And I knew, actually from Farber's notes, that this child had a twin. And so I kept saying, is there, if you please write to me. But there was no response. And so I was dejected. I traveled to India in the middle of writing the book. And it turned out that there was a historian who lived in India, a biographer, who had kept a roster of all these kids who were treated, because he was interested in Farber's life as well. And he had kept a roster of all these kids who were treated for leukemia. And in that roster, I found a cutting of an article from 1948, which told me the name of this child. His name was Robert Sandler. And I came back to Boston, and using the address book from 1948 in the Boston Public Library, and using death records, I could piece together the story of this child's life. And I'll tell you, the last kind of the most moving part of this story is that, so I dedicated the book to, I traveled, I found Robert Sandler's house. I found a picture of his, with his mother and his twin brother. And so I then dedicated the book to Robert Sandler. And then about a 2 weeks after the book was published, I got a phone call in the middle of my day. I was being an oncologist. I was treating patients. And it was Elliot Sandler, Robert Sandler's brother, his twin brother. And he was weeping on the phone. And he said, you know, and he lives in Maine. And he said, you know, it was incredible. I went to the bookstore and I found a book dedicated to my twin brother. And the mother is still alive. And there's a picture of the mother and the twin in the book. Yeah. And the mother, I spoke to the mother through the twin brother. And she was so gratified and moved by this moment. So in a way, yes, your original question was, you know, was I meant to write the book? I don't know about that, but I certainly hope I was meant to discover the family that I'd been trying to find for so long.
Mm. We'll come to this a little later in the program, but I wonder, it seems like there's an important question that seems inevitable part of this story of cancer throughout history. And it is this, which you come to, and we'll sort of work through it a bit, but is it possible to end this disease, you know, or eradicate it? And you say that patients constantly refer to this war on cancer and would inevitably ask, can it even be won? So I wanted to ask you, how does that question sort of fit into the way you're thinking about it? Because it seems more complicated than saying a cure. That's not exactly the way you seem to be thinking about it.
I mean, the word cure is a very important, it's a touchstone word.
Yeah.
In this history. In the middle of the book, I reproduce this incredibly important photograph, incredibly important advertisement that was run in 1969, mm-hmm. which said, Mr. Nixon, you can cure cancer. This was an advertisement meant to raise public funds and essentially create the war on cancer that ran in the New York Times and the Washington Post and many, many other newspapers in 1969. And again, it said, Mr. Nixon, you can cure cancer. The word cure was in the center of the page. And cancer, again, one disease, one cure, one magic bullet. Now, we actually now know that that's unlikely to be the way that we go ahead. It's unlikely to be a single cure because there is no single disease.
Sure.
Even two samples of breast cancer are quite radically different from each other. Two samples of prostate cancer are radically different from each other. So there's unlikely to be a single magic bullet. And I think it's much more likely that we'll never eradicate cancer completely from our society and from our bodies. And the reason is that although we can certainly decrease the number of carcinogens, cancer-causing or cancer-inciting agents, for instance, by decreasing smoking, there are some cancers that are intrinsic to ourselves. And by that I mean that the very genes that allow our embryos to grow, the very genes that allow our brains to grow or our skin to grow, if you mutate those genes, you unleash a cell that doesn't know how to stop growing. Mm-hmm. If you distort those genes, Harold Varma says that cancer is a distorted version of our normal cells.
Yeah.
And so cancer is, in some sense, a distortion of normalcy. It's not something that's only an exogenous reaction, but it's a distortion of normal processes that govern the growth of our cells. And so we cannot, in some very fundamental sense, eradicate cancer from the body because cancer is stitched into our genomes. It is our genetic heritage. We can decrease incidence by changing the spectrum of carcinogens. We can prevent it. We can screen for it. We can treat it. But the idea that we will ever completely eradicate it in the sense, for instance, that we might have eradicated polio or smallpox is very unlikely to be true.
You describe it in the book this way, that if we seek immortality, we human beings, then so too, in a rather perverse sense, does the cancer cell. And does that, you think, explain kind of our strange connection, maybe with the way we don't quite understand the personality? That seems the word, the personality of cancer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that line about immortality relates to the fact that cancer cells, in their capacity to grow forever, have acquired a kind of perverted immortality. They, you know, you can bring out some cancers, not all. You can bring out some cancers into a laboratory, put them on a petri dish with some growth-sustaining media, and they keep on growing forever and forever. You know, there's a wonderful book out recently on the cells of, this is the Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Mm. You know, these cells, cells, her cervical cancer cells drawn from a body of a woman who died several decades ago, are still reproducing, actually in my laboratory. They've been growing this week. And so this idea that you can take these cells and they have achieved a kind of inability to stop growing forever is a kind of perverted immortality. And its ultimate source has to do with the fact that these cancer cells have distorted the very genes that allow our embryos to grow, that allow, you know, normal cells to grow. And normal cells have controls. They seek immortality, but they have a control of their growth, and cancer cells don't. So they keep growing forever and forever. And so, this was pointed out in the book the book is called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, a wonderful book, by the way, in which the author makes the point that these cells have grown several hundredfold times more than the person from whom they were originally derived. So in that sense, there's a chilling sense in which the cancer cells are truly immortal, whereas our bodies, the cells grow and they die, and we are mortal.
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is with us. His book is called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. And XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us to talk about his acclaimed new book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. So if this is a biography of cancer, let's talk about the question you ask in the book, can you find a point where cancer is born? I mean, has it always been with the human organism, or was there a point we figure when it somehow emerged from things? Do we know?
Well, again, the answer has to do with what causes cancer. Yeah. And as we were just talking before, it turns out that cancer is a distortion of normal genes. Cancer is caused by a distortion of normal genes. Not all cancers, but many forms of cancer. By that, I mean that the very genes that allow our cells to grow, if you distort them, if you mutate them, then you begin to unleash a cycle of limitless growth, unstoppable, uncontrollable growth, and that is ultimately what causes cancer. And so the simple corollary to that is that it must be then that cancer has always existed, because the genes that allow growth are ancient genes. These are genes that go right back into our ancient evolutionary history. And so cancer is often thought about as a modern disease, but it's only modern because we as a species are aging, and these mutations occur over time. They accumulate over time. It's almost like they encrust over time. And therefore, many cancers, although not all cancers, many cancers are age-related diseases. They increase often exponentially with age. Prostate cancer, breast cancer, even to some extent colon cancer are age-related. As you age, you get more and more of these mutations, and ultimately you get a cancer cell. So cancer emerges in the modern times because of the fact that the population is aging overall. Just to give you a number on that, I mean, in 1900s, the American population had an average life expectancy in the late 40s, early 50s. Mm-hmm. And today that number has increased by about two decades. And those are precisely the two decades in which cancer begins to arise. So that's why we have more cancer. That's one of the reasons we have more cancer today. But it is absolutely true that if you look back through ancient history, you have the presence of cancer, although we don't know the word for it.
Yeah.
One of the first times that we encounter the word cancer, encounter the phenomenon of cancer, is, in fact, in the very earliest medical textbooks, medical journals that we have as human beings. And that is the Edwin Smith Papyrus, which was originally written around 2500 BC and has one case which is remarkably similar, sounds remarkably like breast cancer.
And this was what I liked about this story was intriguing to hear of the collected teaching of Imhotep, this great Egyptian physician. And what I like about it is you talk about how in the manuscript there isn't a lot of superstition and magic. It's sort of their version of very legitimate science, the way he wrote about this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think every person should, if they have a chance, should read the Edwin Smith Papyrus. This is a document which is not just a document for medical history. It's a document of human history. It is a document that every single person should at some point of time read. I had a friend who's a neurosurgeon. In fact, many of the cases. So the way that the papyrus is organized is that it has case descriptions, case one, case two, case three. Already an incredibly contemporary way of organizing a medical textbook. And every case has a description, a diagnosis, a treatment, and a prognosis. Everything is divided up. And this friend of mine who's a neurosurgeon, actually there are about two or three cases of neurosurgical wounds or neurosurgical complications in the papyrus. And he said to me, you know, if you read that papyrus written 2,500 years ago, and if it doesn't send a chill through your bones, you're in the wrong profession. You know, this is a papyrus written 2,500 years ago, and yet every case is handled as if, you know, as if you're in rounds in a contemporary hospital. And one of them, as I said to you, case 45, is a description of breast cancer, an amazing description in which the Imhotep describes what happens in the breast. And then at the end, and this is what's very moving about it, yeah. Under a little section in which he says, what is the treatment? And he says, there is none.
Is that why, I think, as you describe in the book, because it was seen as untreatable or incurable or in some way inaccessible, that it disappears for a time from ancient medical history?
That's right. And also partly because we don't have a word for it. So it's mixed in with many other words. The word cancer only arises around 400 BC, maybe a little bit later. We have another description from that vast stretch of time, and that's in Herodotus, who wrote the histories. And he describes a case of Queen Atossa, the Persian queen, who has something in her breast, possibly a mass in her breast, or perhaps an inflammatory condition in the breast. Again, we don't have a word for cancer, so we can't tell for sure. It's an amazing story because she has this, and her first response is to hide it. She goes into hiding. She wraps herself in sheets, and she goes into hiding in a kind of a sense of shame around breast cancer. And as we know, that shame will pervade this world for centuries to come. And finally, she allows a Greek slave who's been kidnapped into Persia called Demosthenes to treat her cancer, if it was cancer. And if it was cancer, then it's likely that the Greek slave performed a primitive mastectomy or a lumpectomy because Atossa is cured. That's what Herodotus tells us. And she survives. And she then, she asks Demosthenes to ask for a wish or a gift for having cured her. And Demosthenes says, well, I'm Greek. I'd like to go back to Greece. So Atossa then pleads with her husband to redirect his campaign, his Persian campaign, from the eastern border of Persia to the western border of Persia, thus launching the Greco-Persian War, which, as you know, is kind of the defining moment of the early West. I mean, this is when the empire of Greece moves from its eastern face to its western face, as it were. And so, as I say in the book, you know, even as a word that didn't exist, even as a disease that was submerged, cancer leaves an incredibly important mark in the early history of the West.
So the origins of the name for cancer, names become very important the way we think about it. The early images of how they understood it, I guess, is important of how the disease was treated, how it progressed, how we understood it.
The first time the word cancer comes about is in the writings of Hippocrates.
Right.
And the word cancer, of course, comes from the Greek for crab. And the reason, it's a fascinating reason, Hippocrates imagined cancer as a crab, the lump, dug under the skin with its blood vessels spread outside, much like the legs of a crab under the sand. And it's such a metaphorically rich image, this idea of a crab and the unnatural movement of the crab, the sideways movement of the crab. And so cancer in that moment was imagined as a local disease. Mm. It was imagined as a disease that was much like the crab. And the only way you could cure it at that time, and for subsequently many years, was to dig the crab out and thereby rid the body of cancer.
It's interesting. Hippocrates, the he creates, as you describe in the book, this medical doctrine based on kind of fluid and volume and the idea of humors and keeping the fluids of the body in balance.
That's right.
Talk about how that influences all of the way they're thinking about cancer, because then the thinking, as opposed to removing it, sort of transforms.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Greek physiologists were trying to make sense of how the body works and what disease is. And again, they were searching for unifying principles of disease.
Yeah.
And the Greeks, of course, were particularly obsessed with fluids because they had figured out many of the early laws of fluid mechanics. And perhaps unsurprisingly, this idea of fluids became the basis for a very important theory of Greek pathology. And this was inherited ultimately by Galen, who was a Greek physician who practiced among the Romans. And Galen said, well, there are four fluids, black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm. And the body is comprised of these four fluids, and any disease is an imbalance of these four fluids. So, for instance, hepatitis, jaundice, is an overabundance of yellow bile.
Yeah.
Heart failure is an overabundance of blood. And so Galen, finally, again, borrowing from earlier Greek physiologists, makes the claim that there are only two diseases, actually, that are overabundances of black bile, this mysterious oozing liquid, and they are cancer and depression. In fact, the word melancholia, melancholy, comes from that derivation from melas or black and chole, bile. Melancholy is literally black bile, and cancer is the other overabundance of black bile.
And then you write about sort of the reaction then to this kind of thinking, which leads to lots of bleedings and these purging rituals, which you talk about, but also these fanciful treatments, because people sort of decide against surgery, so they treat the bile, which leads to rasped ivory and fox lungs and boar's tooth and goat's dung and crow's feet and all of these odd ways of, what, extracting the bile?
That's right. I mean, you know, this was a time when surgeons and doctors thought that the only way then to get rid of cancer would be to bleed the black bile out of the body. Yeah. Now, remember, of course, no one had seen black bile. This was a fantastical entity that they had imagined, that conjured up. Mm-hmm. And the theory was so seductive that they had literally conjured it into existence. And there were all these attempts to therefore cut various forms, various blood vessels to lead the black bile out of the body. By the way, it's also a reminder, until the 1970s, actually even today, you can find variations of these kinds of remedies, you know, boar's tooth, fox tooth, this, that, and the other, all across the world for cancer. On one hand, we have an incredibly deep cellular understanding of the disease, but there is such a desperation, understandably, among patients that they will try anything. And if they tried, you know, fox's teeth in 600 BC, they'll try fox's teeth in 2010.
How long did the idea of black bile stay with us? You write about Andreas Vesalius, who writes those beautiful anatomical images, dissecting bodies and creates this anatomical map. And he tries to sort of, in fact, find the black bile, I suppose, but he has to shift gears.
That's right. So, you know, Vesalius and all these medieval anatomists took Galen for his word and said, well, fair enough, there is black bile, overabundance of black bile, but it really must exist somewhere in the body, even if you've never really found it. So Vesalius and the other medieval anatomists go about trying to look for black bile, and they hunt. They're performing these incredibly beautiful autopsies. By the way, the autopsy, the word comes from autosci, which means to see for oneself. So Vesalius is trying to see for himself where he can find black bile, and he cannot. He keeps looking, and Vesalius is a student of Galen's. Several centuries later, he has imbibed every teaching of Galen, and he just cannot find the black bile. And therefore, he concludes, and others conclude after him, that this must have been a fanciful theory, that there must not be any black bile in the body, and that it must have been conjured up.
So what's the next idea that emerged, and at what point does this idea of cutting out the cancer come about?
So then history repeats itself.
Sure.
And surgeons go back and say, well, wait a second, if there is no black bile, if there's no systemic problem in the body that's running all over the body and thereby creating cancers, then cancer must be, as Hippocrates first imagined it, a local disease. It must be a local growth of whatever kind. Again, this is a time before the microscope was invented, so they knew that this was growth. What exactly the growth corresponded to in terms of cells was not discovered yet. And so surgeons began to then cut cancer out locally, reimagining it as a local disease, thereby launching what I call an incandescent century of surgery, in which surgeons really tried to figure out how to cut cancer out from the body. And it's a very important reminder that actually, even until today, if you do find cancer in its local form, surgery is the mainstay of treatment. We have inherited this unbelievable legacy from the 19th century of surgery, which really is probably the most powerful, one of the most powerful weapons against cancer.
You write about how that surgery evolves, and as soon as surgeons really understand that they have to make, you know, really deep cuts to get all of the cancer, these cuts get deeper and deeper, and the surgery is more and more radical. You sort of call it this macabre marathon that happens for a time in history.
And it's a sad story, yeah. Because what happens, and again, it repeats itself, as you know, in the 20th century. But we're now in the 19th century. Surgeons are trying to extract cancer from the body, and they say to themselves, well, if something is good, then more of that something must be better. And so if some surgery can cure some cancers, then more surgery must cure more cancer. Yeah. And particularly in breast cancer, they, led by William Halstead, an unbelievable cocaine-addicted perfectionist surgeon in Baltimore, performs more and more aggressive surgeries, what he calls radical surgery, radical mastectomy, to try to extract out all the cancer from the breast. And so not only is he now cutting into the breast tissue, but all around the breast and deep into the chest cavity, all in the hopes that if he cuts away all of this tissue, then he will cure cancer, breast cancer completely.
It is interesting the way that it's a cycle. It seems, you know, as you say, it keeps repeating itself, our images of cancer. I wonder what you make of that.
Well, this cyclical quality is very important because it reminds us that we're actually not writing. In some ways, this book is not just about the history of cancer. This book is about it's a book about our psychology and the psychology of science. You know, this idea that we try to overreach for goals and we try to understand big natural phenomenon. And that's why I think this book is written for a general audience. Everyone should read about this history because it is a history that will be played out in every single form. It happens to be played out in this book, in cancer. But there's so much from this history that we can learn about the history of medicine in general, the history of science, and perhaps the history of many, many other things that have a similar kind of effort in which you try to achieve something and then it very quickly tips into hubris, into narcissism, into optimism. And how do you recover the project from that point?
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is with us. His book is called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is the author of the book, The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Mukherjee, there are two characters that play an incredibly important role in the story, and I wanted to get to them. The first is Dr. Sidney Farber, extraordinary individual. Talk a little bit about him. He's interesting because in some ways you get a sense that he was not a terribly lovable fellow. I mean, his colleagues in school found him kind of rigid and arrogant, but he had this passion that drove him and was incredibly influential in terms of cancer.
Absolutely. Sydney Farber was a larger-than-life character, and I used him actually to thread together this whole book because I found something very inspirational in his story. Sydney Farber was trained as a pathologist, and as you know, pathologists usually don't treat patients. Yeah. They perform diagnostic procedures. You know, they diagnose diseases by looking at, typically by looking at tissues or performing autopsies. But Farber was very driven by the idea that childhood leukemia could be treated in the 1940s. And he actually had a collaboration with an Indian chemist, an Indian-born chemist who was then working in New York. And he began to inject these children with leukemia with a particular chemical, which is an antifolate, a folic acid antagonist. And in doing so, he found these incredible, although brief, remissions in a disease that had rarely ever been sent into remission. And Farber therefore decided that he had stumbled on something something that he had never encountered in the past, the fact that a chemical could possibly be directed against cancer. And he therefore collaborated with Mary Lasker to launch the war on cancer. A few notes, words about Mary Lasker. Yeah. Mary Lasker,
another interesting character, we should say.
Yeah, Mary Lasker, who was Farber's collaborator, again, a very unusual woman for her times. She had become independently wealthy as an entrepreneur. One of the methods was that she had begun to sell dress designs just immediately after the war, when women's dress designs, prefabricated dresses, at a time when everyone wore tailored dresses. And Mary Lasker said to herself, well, you know, if I just can have a cash and carry prefabricated dress, then everyone is going to work. Women are going to work, mm-hmm. and they need a cash and carry dress. She made a lot of money by creating these dresses. So obviously, a very unusual character for her time, and she became interested in taking all the money that she had made and all her social connections and her social networking and directing that philanthropically towards the what she called the landscape of American health, mm-hmm. changing diseases by marshaling national and local and public forces against diseases. And so Farber and Mary Lasker became collaborators in launching the war on cancer. And it's a very important part of our history, which I write about in this book, which should not be forgotten, the idea that this kind of immense philanthropic energy really emanated from a few individuals who were dedicating their lives to launching a war against cancer.
Well, it's important to understand how important Farber and Lasker are in the context of the time, which you write about the 1940s, the 1950s. Cancer was, I think you describe it this way, was mostly whispered about. Talk about that.
There's a story that I tell in the book that, there's a woman called Fanny Rosenau, a breast cancer advocate, who calls up the New York Times in 1950, and she says, I'd like to place an advertisement for a survivors group of breast cancer patients. And there's a long pause on the phone, and the society editor for the New York Times comes on the phone and says, well, Ms. Rosenau, you know, we can't use the word breast and cancer in the newspaper. What if we said this was a survivor group for women with diseases of the chest wall? The euphemistic quality of it. And as you know, now you can't open the New York Times today without encountering the word cancer. So sure. Enormous changes have been made, not only in our biological understanding of cancer, but in the public perception of cancer. And it's these changes that I wanted to highlight in the book. Where are we today? How did we get here? And what happens next? That's the meat of this book. And I feel that everyone should know this history because it's such an important history. It's going to affect all our lives.
Well, so I guess when you talk about what happens next, we could use this opportunity to ask how modern life has changed the spectrum of cancers. You know, I wonder about the emergence of, because I'm sure you get these questions all the time, the emergence of chemicals and toxins of an industrial age, the arrival of antibiotics and other drugs. How has modern life changed the way, not just the way we think about cancer, but also the way we treat it and the way it's developing in terms of our understanding about it?
Well, I mean, that's an enormous question. Sure. And it probably would be worthwhile breaking it up into little pieces. Let's take the first piece first, which is one thing that's certain is that we are seeing a change, and I talk about this in the book, we are seeing a change in the spectrum of carcinogens. Carcinogens haven't gone away. Cancer-generating chemicals haven't gone away, but their spectrum, their quality, their identity is changing. So we are seeing in some countries a final dip in smoking rates, but a rise in other countries among young men and women. So that's clearly going to contribute to not just lung cancer, but lip and throat and esophageal cancer. So that's one carcinogen who that is in flux. We now know that exogenous hormones, estrogens, taken at relatively high doses, can cause breast cancer. We know that from the studies in which women were treated with these hormones and developed breast cancer subsequently years later. Now, in many cases, the use of such hormones has been discontinued. But one question that's being raised is, what about other chemicals that resemble estrogens? Should we be really looking very hard at those chemicals and finding out which ones of those can have a link with breast cancer or ovarian cancer? Those are just two examples, and there are many, many more. You know, sure. There was a huge controversy recently, which was ultimately shown not to be the case, at least in early trials, of cell phones and the link with brain cancer. Right. So, again, ultimately, a large clinical trial showed that there was no significant association, at least with those cell phones now. In that period of time, the cell phones themselves have changed. So, you know, there is a quality in all of this, and I talk about this in the book, that this is a cat and mouse game. You step one, you know, you put one foot ahead, and you have to reevaluate. But what is happening, Doug, is that we are becoming better and better at understanding the molecular nature of cancer, and we're getting better and better at assessing any given agent to see whether it really incites cancer or not. And I think that will continue over decades to come.
You know, it seems like one of the themes in the book that comes up is that the history of cancer is kind of a chronicle of human imagination. And I wonder if that's how, later in the, you know, you talk about in the book, you describe it as kind of a, for one of your patients, a chess match that requires this constant movement, having to adapt and invent new strategies. And in some ways, it's a kind of a chronicle of how imaginative people have to be able to treat and deal with cancer.
Absolutely. And it's a chronicle of the fact that there are no simple, universal, magic bullet solutions. Mm. And yet, piece by piece, much like solving a jigsaw puzzle, we can begin to solve the problems of cancer. I describe this as a chess game because it feels as if, particularly these days, as newer and newer therapies come up, many patients will encounter a different future in cancer in which treatments are directed to their personal form of cancer. And they will, cancer is an evolutionary beast. It also evolves. As we are growing, cancer keeps evolving and changing. And so what will happen probably is that that these cells will become resistant to this treatment, and then they'll undergo a second round of treatment with a different drug. Mm-hmm. And there will be, there are already mechanisms to prevent cancer or the development of second cancers in such individuals who are susceptible. And so it will become this kind of process in which, you know, you take one step, and then there's another step that comes about, and every step requires a kind of inventiveness. Mm-hmm. Again, not to overuse the battle metaphor, it's very much like marshalling and remarshalling troops and making sure that that once you establish an equilibrium, that equilibrium is a dynamic equilibrium. It has to be reestablished at every stage. There's an analogy that I really like that I use in the book. It's from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland. And, you know, Alice goes up to the Red Queen, and she says that the Red Queen is moving very quickly. She's spinning her feet madly. And Alice says, well, why are you're just standing in the same place. Why are your feet moving? And the Red Queen says, well, you know, it's the world keeps moving backwards at the identical pace. So I'm just moving fast just to stand still. Mm. And it seems to me that that's a very rich metaphor for the way we understand and battle cancer today. We have to keep our feet spinning, really, in order to continue to keep in the same place, to maintain a dynamic equilibrium with cancer.
In the book, you take us on this fascinating thought experiment with that Queen Atossa that you mentioned before, You imagine her traveling through time to be treated in these, you know, various times throughout history. And then you talk about how, sure, we've progressed in many ways, but you also say before we get too dazzled by all of this progress, you have to put it in perspective. And you say that, for example, if you were to give Atossa a metastatic pancreatic cancer in 500 BC, you write that her prognosis is unlikely to change by more than a few months over the course of 2,500 years, which raises the question of how we measure progress. What is progress?
Well, I mean, there are various ways of measuring progress. It's important to say that I use the word prognosis. Mm-hmm. What has changed in many, many years is that the way we are able to take care of patients yeah. with metastatic pancreatic cancer has changed dramatically.
Sure.
And by care, I mean psychological care, nursing care, palliative care, hospice care. These have changed. When such a patient has intractable pain, we have medicines to help us treat that pain. When such a patient has intractable nausea, we have medicines to treat that nausea. So prognosis is only one measure of progress.
Sure.
There are other measures of progress that I talk about in the book, which actually have changed dramatically. But that said, it is absolutely true that metastatic pancreatic cancer lies in the far end of a spectrum of a cancer where we are beginning to understand what drives this cancer and beginning to treat this using targeted therapies.
Doctor, let me ask you this finally. I'm wondering how has understanding the culture, the biography of this disease, I wonder how that's changed the way you approach it as a doctor. Has it changed your clinical approach, for example, or the way you talk to patients?
I think so. I think the way, the first thing, I always believe that medicine, you know, this is a book about the narrative of medicine.
Sure.
Very early on in the book, I say there are stories upon stories in this book, and it's a book about storytelling. And patients are first storytellers. And long before they become involved in medicine, medicine is an act of story getting and storytelling. And the way that I think it's changed my practice personally is that I think I've become more attentive to the stories. And in doing so, I think I've become a more compassionate doctor. There's a great study performed several years ago, which asked the question, how quickly do doctors interrupt their patients once the patient has begun the story? And it's an amazing number. It was 18 seconds. Basically, patients don't even finish one sentence before the doctor interrupts their storytelling and juxtaposes or superimposes their own thoughts about the story. If the Emperor of Malady has taught me one thing, it is that medicine is about storytelling, history is about storytelling, and sometimes 18 seconds is not enough to tell a story. So we should listen.
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. His book is called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Doctor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful program.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez, the show produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.